welcome to Aerie in Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 13th of January, 2020. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at radioalbion.com. Once again, it's the start of another glorious week, and I do have my co-host with me today, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good afternoon to you, sir. How are you doing?
Good afternoon. I'm doing very well, actually. Yes, it's been a good weekend. It's weather-wise, it's been a bit wet and windy, but I've had an enjoyable weekend nonetheless.
Excellent, excellent. And we've had some rather unexpected news this weekend, rather unexpected news that we learned about via the internet, via the Duke and Duchess of Sussex's website. Journalists weren't really made aware of it. The royal family certainly weren't made aware of it, and apparently Meghan Markle and Prince Harry are retiring from the royal family, something which I didn't actually know was possible. They've said that they're going to try to make enough money on their own with their progressive ideas, I guess, but how are they going to pay for the security? I mean, you can't just resign from the royal family. And apparently, as I say, the Queen didn't know about this. Prince Charles didn't know about this. Elton John knew about it straight away, of course. And the press aren't very happy about this. And the press have often been pointing out Meghan Markle's issues. But I don't think anybody could accuse them of being racist. And yet there are a lot of non-white journalists that are accusing the British people of being racist, and that it was racism that's actually driven Prince Harry and Meghan Markle to want to leave the country. And I think this is a complete falsehood. And I've got a list of reasons here why I think that is. But first off, I'll just pass it over to you, Max. I mean, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, it's a pretty big news story, isn't it?
It is quite a big news story, yes. And I think that the thing that's been most shocking about this has been the fact that the Sussexes appear to have made their announcement in defiance of prior agreements that had been made with other senior members of the royal family, i.e. the Queen, etc., that the matter was going to be under discussion and was something that they would try to evolve over time. And yet the Sussexes appear to have gone ahead and made their announcements without really considering the impact that it would have on the standing and the reputation of the royal family. As for the aspects of racism, well, I think that unless you challenge an existing monarch, as has been done in times gone by, and you defeat them on the field of battle or something like that, and so that you claim their monarchy for your own, you can't actually become a monarch without being the direct recipient of DNA from a former monarch. And the House of Windsor is not a celebrity family in the same way that the Kardashians is or something like that. It's not a celebrity family that's predicated on fame and equal rights. It's a royal family predicated on history and privilege. And the very concept of royalty and aristocracy is based upon the notion of genetic exclusivity. It goes beyond naivety, therefore, to expect to introduce into a royal family someone who wants to be seen as a standard bearer for genetic diversity and not realise that they will pose an existential threat, or at least become the cause of considerable disruption and resentment within that family. And so therefore, to think that it would be okay for Harry to marry and introduce into the British royal family someone like someone from Meghan's background was simply delusional, really, on Harry's part and on the part of Meghan's friends. And so I think we've come to a fairly predictable point with regard to the gradual breakdown of the relationship between the Sussexes and the rest of the royal family. To be quite honest, from what I've seen in the news over the last few days, I tend to suspect that the rift will become, has already become an insurmountable rift, because the Sussexes can't really backpedal on what they've declared already without appearing to have been chastised and whipped into line by the more senior members of the royal family. something which I don't think they're sort of that they'd be prepared to accept. They would probably regard that as being humiliating. And so in view of the fact that it's unlikely that they're going to be prepared to accept that, I think that, you know, what's been done has been done. And I would think that something along the lines of what people in the news have been calling a clean break Mexit will probably happen rather than a what's the word I'm thinking of here? I'm using the Brexit analogy and I've lost the analogy now, but you know what I mean.
A brino, sort of leaving the royal family in name only. I think that's probably right, actually yes. What will happen, because they're used to having all this money. I mean, millions are spent on their security. I really blame Prince Harry's tutors. I mean, they've obviously just fed him all this progressive social justice nonsense about there being no difference between races and no difference between people, and he's fallen for it. And because of that, he's fallen for this woman who is part of another race, and she's created merry hell amongst the royal family, basically. Not just that, but because of her feminism, because of all these woke issues that she's interested in, and he obviously hasn't been taught the importance of tradition and the reason why there is a royal family in the first place. I mean, the royals would pick partners from the other royal families in Europe because all the royal families were connected, because they were the royal family. They were blue bloods. And the whole idea was that you would marry somebody, say somebody from Britain would marry somebody from the Russian royal family, and then you would have a link between Britain and Russia, and it was hoped that there wouldn't be war between Britain and Russia. And this was the way that it was done in the past. You would have these alliances that were created through intermarriage between these different branches of the royal family throughout Europe. And instead of doing that, he's been very selfish and thought, well, I'll just marry whoever I like. And I, as I say, I blame the people that brought him up. I blame his teachers for that. And you could tell that he didn't really know what he was doing when he was expecting that the baby that they had was going to look like himself. And he thought it was going to have red hair. And you know, it hadn't actually crossed his mind that the child wouldn't really look very much like him, and possibly wouldn't look very much like Meghan Markle either, because she's mixed race. He obviously hasn't been taught genuine biology. And of course, he's stuck by his wife, which is what a husband should do, but he should also keep his wife in order. And she has created all sorts of problems for the royal family. She's been a great embarrassment to them, I think. I mean, I've got a list here of the things that she's done. I mean, the first one that I've got here is her feminism, and how she broke with tradition and straight away started promoting political issues. And the royal family, in exchange for the position that they're in, we have a constitutional monarchy, which means that they don't actually have a say in politics. They're just there as a figurehead, basically. And they're not allowed to talk about political issues. And the first thing she did was say that she's going to start talking about political issues. And I've got a quote from their own website, and this is from her page on the website. In her year and a half as a member of the royal family, the Duchess has quickly forged relationships with grassroots organisations in her new home of the United Kingdom, offering her support to women in her community. In early 2018, the Duchess visited a small kitchen at the Almanar Heritage Centre that provided access for those in the Grenfell community to cook meals for their families in the wake of the devastating fire that destroyed both lives and homes. With many quiet visits over the course of the year, the Duchess collaborated with the women to highlight the multicultural recipes in a cookbook that enabled the kitchen to be available for use 7 days a week instead of two. I mean, what does she think there, that people only use the kitchen for 2 days a week? Do royals only use the kitchen for 2 days a week instead of 7 days a week? And what is this, all this stuff about helping these women, helping in the community? Is Meghan Markle part of the Grenfell community? Who is her community? Is it the royal family? Is it the non-whites in this country? She's made a big point of going over to Africa and trying to empower women there. She made a big speech about how that's what she was going to do, is empower women and empower black and minority ethnics. And that's all political issues. That is all political issues that the royal family should not be actually having any say about. I mean, if you look at what Prince Harry does, he tries to help people that have been disabled in the forces, and he tries to get that disabled games thing going, which is a very noble endeavor. But that's not political,
Invictus,
is it?
Games, yeah,
Invictus Games. What do you make of this, Max?
Well, I think that part of the problem lies in the example set to both William and Harry of by their mother, and I think she suffered from what H. Millard describes as being the great white mother and the great white father syndrome, which is this sort of syndrome where white people very often will consider it's their life's duty to go to places like Africa where there are underprivileged people and to behave as if they are some Lady Bountiful, a kind of fairy godmother, and to bestow their attention upon these people, to advocate for their cause, etc., and to basically provide them with charity. And that in view of the example that was set by Diana Spencer, so Harry has grown up with the idea that that is a way to, you know, something that he can devote his life to, and Meghan would appear to aspire to emulate Diana Spencer, and so she's very sort of happy with that sort of thing as well. And it's a misconception on the part of people who are outside of royal circles and people who particularly live in countries that are far flung and don't really have that much concept or don't really see to any extent what's going on within our royal family, for example, that the role of people who aren't directly in line for the throne, their role is to play a supporting role to those people who are directly in line to the throne. And so we've got the Queen, who is the current monarch. We've got Prince Charles, who is going to become king after the Queen dies or the Queen steps down. And then we've got William and we've got George, who are going to be, who are the next in line. And so they are the people who are going to be the monarch, and the role of everybody else within the royal family who isn't directly in line is, as I say, to support the monarch in the monarch fulfilling their duties, etc., with regard to the country. And so I think as far as somebody like Meghan is concerned, somebody who's come from a culture where fame and fortune is something that you can win for yourself, and effectively where unbridled fame and unbridled fortune is something that you can win for yourself, it's a bit of a culture shock to suddenly find that instead of being in a fluid situation where she could and where Harry could ratchet himself up the ranks and to effectively then, you know, perhaps at some future date become the next in line to the throne, you know, that was something that was never going to happen to Harry, and so something that was never going to happen for Meghan either. And so to suddenly realise that your entire life is going to be spent playing a supporting role, which is, you know, kind of like being a supporting actor if you come from an acting background rather than being the person who is in the starring position, might be a disappointing realization. And so I think that that probably that those kind of thoughts may well have played into this situation and coloured the judgment of Harry and Meghan. And certainly I think when you are a member of the royal family and you're playing a supporting role, you are subject to certain limitations, and those limitations apply to you because of the fact that by virtue of the fact that you are a member of the royal family, you have privileges lavished upon you in the form of that, you know, wherever you go, you're treated like a celebrity, and that you have all the protection afforded to the royal family, and you have the wealth that most people would regard as fabulous wealth lavished upon you, you know, to the extent that in Harry and Meghan's case, they were provided with Frogmore Cottage to live in for the rest of their days, rent free, and they were allowed to refurbish Frogmore Cottage to the tune of 2.4 million, I think it was. And they are the sort of privileges that ordinary people don't have, and the sort of privileges that people who are in the royal family and who are probably only ever going to be playing a supporting role in the royal family would have as compensation for the fact that they are resigning themselves and their life to a life of playing that supporting role. And I think that members of the royal family aren't supposed to get involved in political issues, as you've already mentioned, but they also aren't supposed to get involved in commercial sponsorship either, because the royal family is supposed to be above commercial matters. The royal family is royalty is all about history, tradition, heritage, etc. And the identity of a nation encapsulated in within the identity of a single family, and the Queen in the past and various kings and queens in the past have allowed companies that produce goods and services that the royal family use, they have allowed them to have this royal seal where they can claim that they supply their produce by royal appointment. And that is something which obviously is quite valued by commercial companies, but it's not done in exchange for commercial sponsorship. So the Queen, if she awards the by appointment to the royal family, if she awards that to a particular company, she doesn't get sponsorship from that company in return for that, because the royal family is above sponsorship. And when the Queen drives to a particular function, she might be driving in a Bentley car, or she might be driving in a Rolls Royce or something. She does that because that's what that they are the cars that are provided for her. She doesn't get sponsorship from Rolls Royce or from Bentley by virtue of the fact that she is seen using their things. Whereas if you try to milk the commercial opportunities that might be available to somebody who is in the royal family or somebody who is marginal to the royal family, then you will be entering into commercial sponsorship deals whereby you will perhaps buy a certain brand of perfume, or you might buy a certain brand of wristwatch or something like that, and you are given commercial sponsorship on the basis that you make sure that you are seen in distinguished company wearing your distinguished watch, or sporting your favorite aroma. And these are things that would take the royal family in a direction that it's never been intended to go, which would be towards, as I say, commercialism. The royal family should be above commercialism. It should be about, as I say, the nation's identity and the encapsulation of the nation's identity within a single family.
Yeah, it would cheapen it, wouldn't it? I mean, is that what they're intending on doing then?
You know, well, that's what it appears to be from, if you read the news. I mean, if the newspapers are completely wrong, then that may not be the case, but that appears to be what's being suggested.
Well, they need something to make some money for them. I mean, you brought up Prince Harry's mother there, but what about Meghan's mother? Meghan's mother appears to be the only part of her family that she's on speaking terms with. I mean, that really sort of said to us, I think, well, she's trouble, basically. If you look at what happened at the wedding, there was no family of hers at the wedding, just her mother. And where the family would normally be, there were a lot of celebrities. Oprah Winfrey, Serena Williams, George Clooney. And these are obviously the people that Meghan Markle thinks a lot of. Other celebrities. She doesn't think much of her family. It was her father that actually really slogged his guts out to pay for her to go to acting school because she wanted to be an actress, and she wouldn't even have him there. She wouldn't have him there. And there's been lots of bad blood between them in the press, where he has actually spoken to the press about this. But this was really a sign of what was going to come, I think, because now she's ended up splitting Harry up from his family. And this is what people were saying that actually knew her. They said she's treated her family really badly. She splits people up from their family. And this seems to be exactly what she's done. And Harry is just just going along with it. I mean, after that, she had the pregnancy, which she announced at Princess Eugenie's wedding. So she upstaged Princess Eugenie. When she had the baby, she refused to show the public the baby. This is the public that are actually paying for everything for her. She refused to say who the godparents were. We still have hardly actually seen the baby at all. And then she turned up at Wimbledon wearing jeans, unannounced. And you're not allowed to wear jeans in the royal box. I mean, there is a protocol. There is rules that you are supposed to obey when you go to Wimbledon. And she thought she didn't have to obey them. And she also banned anybody from taking any selfies. And she banned people from taking pictures of her. Even journalists were banned from taking pictures of her. And it was all this sort of behaviour that caused multiple staff to resign, saying that she was absolutely impossible to work for. And now you've got people saying, it was racism. And this is not racism. This is the woman being an impossible person to work with. And I'm sure these people that have actually spoken out about this, I'm sure that they have felt that they absolutely must speak out about it, because they knew that they would get accused of racism for doing it. And this is the excuse that is used by non-whites. They can just blame racism for anything, any criticism that actually gets leveled at them. And she seems to be doing the same. They went to Africa, and this was to highlight rape and landmine victims. And instead of it highlighting rape and landmine victims, it became all about Meghan Markle. One of the interviewers said, asked her if she was okay. And she said, nobody's asked me if I'm okay through all of this. And instead of it being about these victims, it became all about Meghan Markle saying that she's not okay, she hasn't been treated well, and how she's all upset. And you think, well, how many people in Britain would love to be in the position that Meghan Markle is? I mean, all little girls dream of being a princess, but apparently that's not good enough for her. Then they arrive by private jet to climate camp, along with others that arrived by private jet. And it came out that they were sort of just flying off around the world to wherever it is they wanted to go at the same time, whilst claiming to be caring about the environment. And, we're only going to have two children, because Harry's brother, Prince William, of course, he has three children. She guest edited the Vogue edition, the special woke Vogue edition. And instead of putting beautiful women on the cover, I think she must have just been looking for the ugliest feminists that she could find. And again, she made it all about politics instead of about how beautiful women can look, and fashion, and all the rest of the that you sort of get in Vogue. And then you get up to Christmas, and you've got the Duke of Edinburgh, who's been ill. He was taken into hospital. He had to have emergency surgery. And they didn't even join the royal family for Christmas. And then finally, we get this big announcement to quit without actually telling the Queen first, or without even telling Prince Charles first. Apparently, they discussed that they might be wanting to do this. And the royal family said, well, just hold back on that, and we'll see if we can come to some kind of compromise between us all. And then they just went back on their word and published it on their website and just told the world what they're doing. These are the reasons why the press appear to have turned against Meghan Markle, is because, you know, there's just a litany of bad behaviour that has actually come from her. Max, do you want to make any comments on this list here?
Well, first of all, what I'd just like to say is that I didn't mean to imply that the Sussexes had already lined up sponsorships, that they were going to enter into commercial sponsorships. Commercial sponsorships was something that the press has speculated that they may enter into in order to boost their income in the future. So that's just an issue for speculation in the future. As far as the Sussexes are concerned, one thing I would say, to a certain extent in their favour, is that and I mentioned about the fact that, you know, when you are a minor royal, you are effectively just playing the part of a supporting role to the person who is directly in line for the throne. If you go back hundreds of years, if we go back to the time of, for example, the sort of kings and queens of the medieval times, then what would have happened there is that monarchs would have tended to lead their armies into battle, And so therefore there was always a fairly high risk if a country was at war that the monarch would actually be killed. And so for somebody who is perhaps the brother of the person who is directly in line for the throne, for that person to play a supporting role had within it the prospect that they might one day gravitate to being the person who is actually in direct line for the throne by virtue of the fact that they're older brothers, etc., were killed in battle. And so I think from the point of view of the way in which the royal family functions, it's has obviously been formed, and the traditions, etc., that apply to the way in which members of the royal family conduct themselves have been formed over many hundreds of years in a situation where those playing the supporting role would have the prospect at some point in the future of perhaps becoming the central player, the person who is directly in line for the throne and who actually becomes the monarch. Today, though, we have a situation where I think Harry is something like fifth in line to the throne, and each time William or Kate have a child, it ratchets back Harry another place, so he's then going to be sixth and seventh and eighth in line for the throne. And so the prospect of him ever achieving the centre stage, in so to speak, becomes more and more remote the older he gets. And so it is a situation where at a time when people are encouraged through the education system to think of themselves as individuals, and at a time when people, particularly in America, but it's also becoming the same sort of culture exists in the UK now, where people are made to think they can be anything they want to be, and if they want to be it hard enough, then they can become it. What people who are peripheral to the royal family find is that that doesn't actually apply to them. And so although the benefits that they have in exchange for sacrificing their life to play that supporting role, although those benefits may appear fabulous to us mere mortals, to people who are operating in show business, who are operating in the upper end of show business, who are film stars and actors, etc., and who are in receipt of very large fees for doing the playing the roles that they do, the kind of wealth that peripheral royals enjoy might not appear that wonderful, and so they may think to themselves, well, you know, why would I want to sacrifice my entire life playing this supporting role, knowing that I'm never ever going to be called upon to actually take centre stage, when I can earn as much money, if not more money, doing other things and paddling my own canoe somewhere else. And so it's understandable that those kind of temptations play upon Harry's mind. It's very understandable that those sort of temptations would be in the forefront of Meghan's mind, because she's, you know, come directly from a culture in the United States where this sort of personal ambition is a very important thing. And where the royal family as an organization, I think, have slipped up is that they haven't made sure that the people who are directly in line for the throne, and also people who are immediately supportive of them, i.e. the future monarch's brother, that they are sufficiently sufficiently used in the traditions of the monarchy to be prepared to sacrifice to that extent. And I think that's really where the royal family's fallen down. And it's all part of the transition that's been going on within the royal family from being a kind of mysterious family that's remote from the people, as they would have been at the beginning of the 20th century, to trying to be this kind of modern, progressive family that the news media want them to be, but which in reality they can't really be without making themselves either look foolish and look irrelevant by today's standards, and so it is a difficult thing for them all to wrestle with, I think.
Destined to fail. It is destined to fail. As you say, I mean, just as you were saying that, I was thinking, you know, what Harry should have done is looked into tradition and been the defender of tradition. I mean, if they're going to be in that position and they haven't got a lot to do, well, that is what they should be doing. All the pomp and pageantry and ceremony, they should have got involved in that. And understand that's just what you have to do if you're born into the royal family. I mean, she must have known. She knew what she was marrying into, and yet she was that arrogant. She thought she could do something else and be an individual. And now she's going to split the royal family up and split Harry off from his family. It's something that I'm sure he's going to live to regret, so that he can be an individual. But as I say, the non-white press have been blaming racism for all of this, particularly Afua Hirsch, who I'm sure some of our listeners are aware of. And she was writing for the New York Times, and she said, "Meghan, Duchess of Sussex, has been persistently subjected to comments in the British media about her race." And I don't think that's true. I think the only time it's been mentioned, they sort of said, "Oh, beautiful mixed race Meghan," or something like that. And if they hadn't have mentioned it, Meghan would have been sure to mention it, because she's talked about how she wants to help black and minority ethnic communities. It's Meghan who makes her race central. She continued with, "If the media paid more attention to Britain's communities of colour, perhaps it would find the announcement far less surprising." It seems to me that that's all the media ever does, is pay attention to Britain's communities of colour. They're on every single advertisement. We have to have them in every single television programme now. The diversity agenda is so apparent everywhere, yet this journalist is apparently blind to that. She said, "In Britain's rigid class society, there is still a deep correlation between privilege and race. The relatively few people of colour, and even fewer if you count only those who have African heritage, who rise to prominence and prosperity in Britain, are often told we should be grateful or told to leave if we don't like it here." Well, yes, you should be grateful if you make it big in another country. And if you don't like it and you're going to complain about it, well, you've always got that other country that you came from that you can go back to. She says, "The legacy of Britain's history of empire, a global construct based on a doctrine of white supremacy." Well, a lot of the Britain's history of empire was about going abroad and trying to help these other peoples and bringing them civilization, bringing them medicine, bringing them literature, bringing them hospitals, bringing them communications, building them railroads. It was all about encouraging these people to get to a certain level of civilization where they could actually rule for themselves, which is what they have now. She says, "Its pioneering role in the slave trade and ideologies of racism that enabled it." It was the British Empire that did away with slavery. And the slave trade has been around for thousands of years. The Romans were involved in it, the Muslims were involved in it, the Vikings were involved in it. Everybody was involved in it. It was pretty much the equivalent of what we have today as employment. Back then, the slave owner would provide everything. It's just now you get given tokens that you can go out and you've got a bit more choice of what you spend your tokens on. So the British people did away with it. She said, "Policies of recruiting people from the Caribbean and Africa for low-paid work and then discriminating against them in education and housing is with us today." Why should we be providing education and housing to foreigners that just turn up on our shores? And we didn't go to the Caribbean to recruit them. They just came here after the war. We said, we've got jobs here. And they came over here. They wanted to come over here. And then when the jobs were finished, they decided they wanted to stay. We just shouldn't have to pay for everything for them. And then finally, she says, "The scandal surrounding the wrongful deportation of black British people in recent years is still reverberating." Well, it was very few that were actually deported. And if in the last 50 years that they had been here, if they had actually applied for a passport or a driving license or some form of documentation to say they were a citizen, they wouldn't have been deported. And no, what about the white people that have been deported? What about the conservative journalists that have tried to come to Britain that have been kicked out? Well, there's white people from America all over Europe that have been kicked out of countries. Greg Johnson, Jared Taylor, Brittany, whatever her name is, and I momentarily forget the name of those two American girls that came over to Britain to interview Tommy Robinson, and they were kicked out. And that's more of a scandal to me, is the fact that we have white people that are being kicked out of the country simply because of their politics, rather than black people being deported because they couldn't prove that they were actually citizens. And according to Raphael Hirsch, these are all the reasons why Meghan Markle is leaving for Canada, nothing to do with her bad behavior. Again, which goes back to what I was saying, that this racism canard is just used to excuse black behavior. Max, I don't know if you want to comment on that before we move on to Alfred the Great.
What I would say is that it's fairly clear that in terms of their charitable work and the functions that they've attended, that Harry and Meghan have tended to put in an appearance at functions that are disproportionately to do with ethnic minorities in this country. So I would agree with what you said, that they have tended to make the interests of ethnic minority communities and ethnic minority individuals in this country their priority. I would be very interested to see some kind of a statistical breakdown that actually makes a comparison between the number of social centres that they visited that are directly linked to ethnic minorities versus the social centres, etc., that that are directly applicable to the indigenous population, to see what the ratio is and compare that with other royals. And I think that, well, certainly the impression I've gleaned is that they have tended to direct themselves at improving the lot of non-white people on the basis that those non-white people are less less affluent than white people, and certainly they've spent a lot of time in Africa, that sort of only goes to add to that. And I think that just going back to what I said right at the very beginning, really, which is that the very concept of royalty and aristocracy is based upon the notion of genetic exclusivity. You know, I couldn't, unless I was to raise an army and then sort of carry out a coup in this country, I couldn't become the King of England by virtue of the fact that, and I never could, just simply by virtue of the fact that I don't carry the DNA of the Windsor family. You can't actually have a group of people the basic concept of which is any more genetically exclusive than that. You know, that royalty and aristocracy are built upon the notions of human inequality, and so therefore for somebody to think that they could be a standard bearer for genetic diversity and to come and join a family that's whole tradition is predicated on that main principle, and to join the family and for it not to cause ripples, for it not to cause some disruption, for it not to cause some resentment, is just, you know, completely, as I said, it goes beyond naivety to expect that that's going to happen. Now, the members of the royal family would never be so rude or crude as to sort of say to Meghan, you know, go away because we don't want a non-white person being in our family. But the fact of the matter is that William did have a conversation with Harry, so we are led to believe, in which he questioned whether Harry should spend a bit more time thinking about who he was going to marry before he eventually made his decision. That is supposed to be the root cause of the split between the two brothers. I don't know whether that's true or not, but from what we can see, there would appear to be some mileage in that suggestion. So the situation that we're in is something which, in my view, was wholly predictable, and it's just a calamity that nobody has stepped forward and said, you know, this is something that you are meddling with, which you shouldn't be meddling with unless you want to cause disruption and unless you want to cause unhappiness in the British royal family.
No, perhaps he does. I mean, that's where the blame lies, is with Harry, actually. It's not with Meghan. It's with Harry for suggesting it. Well, let's say move on to better royalty, royalty that really deserved to be royalty, Alfred the Great. And I'm hoping we're actually going to finish the Alfred the Great series today. Last week we were talking about the Alfred the Great writing the Bible out into English. And you were bringing up, Max, that this must have been one of the first times that things were actually written down in the vernacular. And I looked that up. And yeah, you're correct there. German literature, it wasn't until the Middle Ages when stuff was actually written down in German. And in France, it was in the 11th century. And yet here we have Alfred translating the Bible into English in 870. Before that, we had Beowulf. And apparently there are works that go back to about the 5th century. So really when the Saxons came over, and I guess the Britons before that were writing stuff down in Welsh, basically. So we have a very, very long history of actually writing stuff down, translating stuff into English and writing in our vernacular instead of just using Latin. I also wanted to confirm my reason for quoting Alfred on the Jews last week. That was to show that this was church teaching at the time that he was talking about. It wasn't from any actual experience that he had with the Jews. And then getting on to this week, I'm going to talk a little bit about might and wisdom. Historian Richard Abels sees Alfred's educational and military reforms as complementary. Restoring religion and learning in Wessex, Abels contends, was to Alfred's mind as essential to the defence of his realm as the building of the boroughs. As Alfred observed in the preface to his English translation of Gregory the Great's Pastoral Care, kings who fail to obey their divine duty to promote learning can expect earthly punishments to befall their people. The pursuit of wisdom, he assured his readers of the Boethius, was the surest path to power. Quote, study wisdom then, and when you have learned it, condemn it not. For I tell you that by its means you may without fail attain to power, yea, even though not desiring it. Close quote. So it's just as important to Alfred that he educate his people as that he defend his people, and not just educate his people, but also teach them about the spiritual side of life. If you look at the books that he translated, The Consolation of Philosophy by Boethius, Ecclesiastical History, Bede, Pastoral Rule of St. Gregory the Great, The Dialogues of St. Gregory the Great. In fact, the only book here that isn't religious or philosophical is The History of the World by Orosius. And he was also responsible for a translation of that. Do you want to comment on any of that, Max?
I don't think that there's anything sort of particularly significant I can add to that, really. I think you know, what you said covers the situation fully, actually. I can't think of anything to add to it at the moment, I think.
That's okay. We can move on to Alfred the Christian Nationalist. The portrayal of the West Saxon resistance to the Vikings by Asser and the Chronicler as a Christian holy war was more than mere rhetoric or propaganda. It reflected Alfred's own belief in a doctrine of divine rewards and punishments, rooted in a vision of a hierarchical Christian world order in which God is the Lord, to whom kings owe obedience and through whom they derive their authority over their followers. The need to persuade his nobles to undertake work for the common good led Alfred and his court scholars to strengthen and deepen the conception of Christian kingship that he had inherited by building upon the legacy of earlier kings such as Offa, as well as clerical writers such as Bede, Alcuin, and the other luminaries of the Carolingian Renaissance. This was not a cynical use of religion to manipulate his subjects into obedience, but an intrinsic element in Alfred's worldview. He believed, as did other kings in 9th century England and Francia, that God had entrusted him with the spiritual as well as physical welfare of his people. If the Christian faith fell into ruin in his kingdom, if the clergy were too ignorant to understand the Latin words they butchered in their offices and liturgies, if the ancient monasteries and collegiate churches lay deserted out of indifference, then he was answerable before God, as Josiah had been. Alfred's ultimate responsibility was the pastoral care of his people. So he saw himself as the shepherd of his people, as the shepherd of his flock, needing to defend his people and needing to get his nobles working for the common good, not working for themselves, not working for corporations or businesses, but they needed to be working for the common good of the people. I mean, this is nationalist doctrine here, that the common good, the good of the nation comes before everything else. And that was most important to Alfred, and he saw that as his Christian duty, was to do this. It was to bring the nation together and improve everything about their lives, basically. And that was what he encouraged his nobles to do. That was the aim of the Alfredian reign, basically. And this,
I think this demonstrates the sort of intellectual rigor of Alfred. The fact that he developed this concept, which wasn't limited to one particular area of life, that it was an all-encompassing worldview that he had in terms of providing for the well-being of his people, whether it was religious, commercial, physical, or pastoral, as you say. And particularly with pastoral, I mean, that's has sort of echoes today, really, with a lot of people now being concerned with the mental health of people in our busy society. Well, in the times of Alfred, they didn't have all of the same technical things that they needed to encompass. They didn't have high technology items that they had to become accustomed to and know how to work, etc. But in the life that they had then, the stresses that they would have been under would have been the sort of stresses that would have come from the grief of having your village attacked by, you know, perhaps Vikings, and having the women folk raped and the buildings burnt down and all of your wealth stolen. There would have been lots of people who in those days would have been severely vexed by all sorts of emotions resulting from that, and in having care for the pastoral well-being of his people, that again shows a sort of a hidden depth of intellectual consideration on the part of Alfred. And again, as I think I said last week, everything we learn about Alfred basically demonstrates what a truly great person he was.
A true patriarch as well. I mean, because he saw the nation as his family, and he was the head of that family, and he was answerable to God, the same as a man should be answerable to God, and his wife answerable to the man, and the children answerable to the wife. And he saw that as being the same for the king, basically. The king had to obey God. He was God's emissary on earth, and it was up to the king to institute the correct laws, the laws of the Bible, and to ensure that there was justice, as we mentioned before about him sitting in on the courts to make sure that there was no corruption that was going on, and hanging these judges. And he took his position as king incredibly seriously. I mean, it's so different to the royals that we have today, and the way that you know, they don't really seem to have any concern at all for their people. I mean, these at this time, you had kings that were willing to die for their people, and they did die on the battlefield fighting for their people. But having a look at his Christian piety and charity, Alfred divided all his revenue into two portions. The first portion was for secular affairs, and this was divided into three portions, with the first going to his fighting men and to his noble thanes, who worked in three groups in shifts, 1 month on and 2 months off. Each was paid according to his rank and office. The second portion went to the craftsmen he had assembled, and the third was used for diplomatic gifts to the Welsh, Scots, Danes, and Irish that came to him, each according to his station. So this would have come from the equivalent of taxes, I guess. This was his revenue, and half of it was going on defence of the realm, improving the realm with the craftsmen, and also getting on well with the other nations that there were in Britain at the time. And there were Irishmen that turned up in a coracle, and he looked after them, and he fed them, and then sent them on their way. They were on a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. But the second portion went on spiritual affairs, and this was divided into four portions. And the first went to the poor of all the nations in Britain that came to him. So you could go to the king and ask for help, and he would give you help. I guess that's the equivalent of unemployment or sickness benefit that we have today. The second went on the two monasteries that he had instituted, and the third went on the school he had started for bright boys of both noble and peasant birth. And the fourth portion went to the neighbouring monasteries throughout the Saxon land and Mercia. So you can see how important his religion was to him. And half of the money that went to on religious purposes went on looking after the poor and on the education system. So that was seen as a religious duty to do that. That was your duty to God to look after these people and in improve their education. And there's a interesting way it's an interesting thing that he invented, actually, because his actual time that he had, he also promised to split in two and then devote half of it to the church. And in order to do this, he invented the candle clock and a way to keep it going when the weather was windy. And he actually did this by scraping down a cow horn until it was paper thin so that it would allow the light through. And then he could put the candle inside of it because he noticed that when he tried to use his candle clock, the wind would blow the thing out. So he's quite well known for inventing this. So, I mean, he probably invented a lot of other things, and I'm sure his craftsmen did as well. But this shows us that he had a good system here for looking after the welfare of his people. And also this shift system, I think, is good. 1 month on and 2 months off. So he would always have a fighting army that were ready there to defend the nation against the Danes, all ready there with their army and their pike, their armour and their pike staffs and their hammers and their swords. And they would just change for the other lot. And have 2 months off. And that was the same for his noble thanes as well, who were there obviously teaching at the school and working in the courts and doing all the other political things that they needed to do, just working for 1 month and then having 2 months off. I mean, it makes a big difference, for big change from the sort of working patterns that we have today. And of course, we mentioned a couple of episodes back as well about all the days off that everybody had, the days off by law, but there was also, you know, just the shift system that he invented gave people a lot of time off. What do you make of his revenue, what he did with the revenue here, Max?
Well, I think this is another example, really, of him melding a recognition of human inequality, because, you know, he was a king of England and he would have had a very sort of clear ideas of the degrees of nobility of the various families of England who he would have gone to seek their assistance in establishing the nation. But it's this recognition of human inequality and this hierarchy of society, where you're talking about how various people within, depending upon their station within society, would have a certain, be regarded as having a certain value, etc. But it's this recognition of human inequality together with the sense of duty and responsibility that fell upon the shoulders of those people who were so privileged, for them to care for the well-being of the people in their charge and that they were responsible for leading. It's just a great thing, really, and it's a demonstration of the depth of thought that went behind it, that's created a system which would have been to some extent revolutionary in its time, and which has lessons for us to learn even in the modern era.
He had noblesse oblige, so the rich saw the poor as being something that was necessary, because if you didn't have the poor, you wouldn't have such a thing as charity. Charity was a good thing. It was good to help people out. And he didn't just help out the English and the Saxons, but he helped out the Danes and the Welsh and the Irish and whoever came to him from Britain. And he wasn't trying to say, oh, well, we are all equal. He was saying, well, we have different castes. And this is why we have the Vergild. Some people are worth more to society than others. But we're not going to let the people that really can't do that much for themselves, we're not going to let them get so poor as to end up getting ill and live in poverty. We're going to help raise them up. And it was done on an individual basis rather than, well, we'll just hand out all this money to people. I think that is interesting as well. And because the king should be the poor man's champion. I mean, later on, it was the king that would stand up for the poor against the nobles. The nobles would be wanting to make as much money as they could out of the lower classes, and the king was there to represent the lower classes, and he would fight their case against these nobles. And it was the same in the courts. Alfred would go in the courts to make sure that justice was evenly distributed. It was equally distributed, and everybody had the right to have their case heard. There may have been more compensation for the nobles than there were for the churls, but that was just based on the value that they actually had to society. And once they did away with the church, I mean, this really sort of got taken on by the government with the welfare state, which just encourages people not to work, basically. But before we had the welfare state, this was something that was done by the church. And because Alfred was such a strong, pious Christian man, he took this on. Half his time was devoted to the church. He was actually made into a saint after his death. He's a saint in the Catholic Church and also in the Orthodox Church. I mean, we talked about earlier in one of the earlier episodes about how his brother was still saying mass when instead of going out onto the battlefield, and King Alfred himself would often sneak out early in the morning and prostrate himself on the floor at the local church, deep in meditation and penitence before God. I mean, he's a really God-fearing man. I mean, this is at the time when Christianity was a very, very positive force for the white nations. Obviously, it's been corrupted now, but back then, I would say that it was an incredibly positive force and also a uniting force, because, you know, it wasn't just the Saxons that he was looking out for. The Welsh, the Scots, the Danes and the Irish, they were all coming to him. And he was uniting them all, basically, and he ended up defending the Welsh from the Vikings. You know, this is the way that royalty should be. I think he quite deservedly was given that title of Alfred the Great. He died in 899, around the age of 50, after siring 5 children, one of whom went on to become the Lady of the Mercians, Queen Ethelfled, who played a huge role in the later conquest of the Danelaw. And she is still honoured today there in the Midlands, this famous Queen Ethelfled. And he was given the epithet the Great during and after the Reformation in the 16th century. The only other king of England given this epithet is Canute the Great, obviously one of the later Danish kings there. But I mean, all around, this guy is just an absolute British hero, basically. All the things that he did, the example that he set. And of course, you know, you may get bad kings, but when you get a good one, you know, they stand the test of time. And we're still talking about him today. 1200 years later, we're still talking about Alfred the Great and the amazing things that he did for the country. It's just a shame that there weren't more like him, and the royalty today don't look to him for an example, you know, who put tradition and before all else, really, and obeying the way that he should be and looking after his people.
Yeah, we spent a considerable amount of time talking about Alfred, and I think that some people might have thought we were spending a bit too much time, but I think, as I said earlier on, the more you learn about Alfred, the more you appreciate how great a monarch he was, and particularly in his time, and the fact that he lived and he had the attitudes that he did, and he formulated the systems that he did at a time when there was nothing else like it anywhere in the world.
Well, we need to have these role models, these archetypes. You know, we need to learn about these people in our history and the great things that they did, and realize that, you know, they're distant relatives of ours. If they were capable of doing these things, we're capable of doing these things. You know, I don't believe we should be teaching our children, you know, the bad things that we've done and trying to make them feel guilty for what they've done. We should be saying, you know, we had these great heroes in our past, and we have the capability to be like that today. I mean, we need to be inspiring people, not beating them down and making them feel guilty and making them feel worthless and saying, well, you know, you're just the same as everybody else. We should be saying, no, you're not the same as everybody else. You have this glorious history that goes back, you know, even before the Romans. And Alfred the Great is, you know, he's been a hero of mine for well over 10 years now, since I first read the life of Alfred the Great and was amazed to learn just all these wonderful things that he actually did, and imagining what life was like back then. And then you come up with the question of, well, was it really the Dark Ages? Because it seems to me to be quite a merry old time, to be honest. Work for 1 month, have 2 months off, free schooling for the bright kids among the peasants. I mean, it's all those days off, all those holy days as well, days off for slaves. And I don't think it was a Dark Ages at all. It was a Renaissance time, really, for England, with Alfred looking to what Charlemagne had done on the continent and wanting to do the same thing here in England. And once he had defeated the Vikings and Christianized Guthrum, you know, the Danes decided to settle and stopped really doing all their raping and pillaging, and they started sowing crops and bringing their own women over. And we had the Dane Law, and we had, as just mentioned, King Canute, and there were various other Danish kings that we had, and Anglo-Saxon kings before the Normans came over. I think, and the artwork, the craftwork that they did. I mean, there are still a lot of old crosses that you can find that were created by the Saxons, and the brooches that they made, and the weapons. A lot of incredible craftsmanship that actually went on at the time. And it was all, you know, it all started by this one king, Alfred the Great. I take my hat off to him. Anyway, thank you for coming on today, Max. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. Don't forget, we do have a Bitcoin wallet, and we do require donations to keep Radio Albion going. We will be back next week with more Air in Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.